talk, first of all, to Mary from Sacramento here. Mary, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have called in about this before. My phone tends to hang up on you, so I hope that doesn't happen. I'm looking at Philippians chapter 3, verses 10 and 11. Can you explain what that means and the relationship of the two verses to each other?
The relationship of the two verses to each other?
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, thank you for your call. Paul said that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, if by any means I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. Now, as far as what he means by his desire to know Christ in the fellowship of his sufferings and the power of his resurrection, I'm assuming that he's saying that there's both aspects of Christ to be known. Christ went through intense sufferings, and he also has been vindicated and empowered by his resurrection. And his resurrection is that by which we experience a spiritual resurrection of rebirth. And so we experience his resurrection power, but we also, Paul says, must also experience suffering. And that's part of our fellowship with him, too. Fellowship, the word koinonia, means sharing together, participating together in something. So we're sharing in a common experience with Christ, which is one of the things that, when it comes to relationships, helps to deepen relationships with between two parties. If two people are friends, but one has suffered very much and the other has suffered very little, there are areas of the life of the sufferer that are not known and cannot really be known firsthand by the friend who hasn't suffered. Not that we should desire suffering, you know, unnecessarily, but that Paul was suffering for his relationship with Christ, and he was seeing that as something that drew him into a closer intimacy with Christ, because Christ suffered, and now when you go through sufferings like your friend has, or like somebody you're in a relationship with has, if you've gone through sufferings together, that really bonds you together in a way that other people don't experience. And I think that he's saying that Christ suffered, and Christ continues to suffer, by the way. Paul said in Colossians that he was pleased that he, in his body, was filling up the measure of the sufferings of Christ for the church. What he was apparently saying is that Christ still suffers. Even though he's gone to heaven, he still suffers through his body's suffering. And we are his body, and when we suffer, he suffers in us. And Paul sees himself as, you know, enduring along with Christ the sufferings that must be suffered in favor of the church's well-being and growth and maturity and expansion. And that's, you know, that gives him a place of connecting with Christ that he wouldn't have at a level that's the same if he didn't suffer also. So I think to fellowship with Christ in the fellowship of his, or to know Christ in the fellowship of his suffering, he's simply talking about how these sufferings do not damage his spiritual life. If anything, they bring him into a more intimate knowledge of Christ, because Christ has suffered. Now Paul knows more what it's like. The power of the resurrection, I think he's talking about the general supernatural nature of the Christian life, where Christ in us, the resurrected Christ in us, gives us the power over temptation when we are trusting in him, and just working supernaturally in our lives, that he wants to know Christ in this supernatural respect, not just in an academic respect. I think a lot of people are content just to know what the doctrines are of Christianity, and may even mistakenly think that that's what it is to be a Christian, is to approve the doctrines. Paul assumes that being a real Christian means you've had a transformation supernaturally called regeneration. And this is the power of Christ's resurrection at work in us. So we have an inward new heart given to us. We have inward work in us to will and to do of his good pleasure. These all exist in us because of Christ's resurrection, and they are the resurrection power of Christ at work in us, transforming us. And then, of course, so Paul sees knowing Christ as having multiple dimensions. A person might know Christ, or we might say know a lot about Christ from reading the Bible, but knowing Christ experientially involves this inward power of Christ transforming us into his likeness more and more, and us going through suffering so that we share in that aspect of Christ's experience as well. Now, he says, if by any means I may attain to the resurrection from the dead, this is an interesting statement because the Bible teaches that everybody's going to rise from the dead. So Paul must mean the resurrection of the righteous. I mean, it goes without saying that he wants to rise with the righteous, not with the wicked. So he's suggesting that I want to be qualified when Jesus comes to be raised with the righteous. And since I expect to be raised with the righteous, I can endure suffering in this present life because there's a life of glorification in the resurrection later on when Christ raises the righteous. So it's my desire to qualify for that that makes me welcome the sufferings of this present time. Paul did not assume that just because he had been converted on the road to Damascus, that there was nothing that could happen to prevent his being part of the righteous. Because Paul did not believe, as many Christians do today, in an unconditional eternal security. Paul believed that, you have to live with Christ. You have to walk with Christ. You have to have a life connected with Christ in order to be a Christian. And though some people connect with Christ at some point earlier in their life, they sometimes neglect that or give it up later on. And he's, especially under suffering, when people are being tortured or suffering for their faith, that's a temptation to them to depart from the faith. And Paul was going through that kind of suffering, and he was saying, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give up on this. It's like what he said in 1 Corinthians 9, when he said in verse 26 and 27, this is the last two verses of 1 Corinthians 9, Paul said, therefore I run thus, he's talking about running in a race, comparing himself to an athlete, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So he's saying, I have preached to others, but I don't want a time to come when I myself would be disqualified. And by the way, the word he uses there in the Greek is the same word you find in Romans chapter 1, which is translated reprobate, where you find the word reprobate in Romans 1, that God gives them over to a reprobate mind. That's the same Greek word Paul uses to speak of what he doesn't want to become in the last line of 1 Corinthians 9. So Paul sees that just having a resume of having served Christ for many years is not all that matters. He needs to continue to serve Christ. He needs to deepen his walk with God. He needs to know Christ. And he needs to keep that up in the face of sufferings and challenges and things that would tempt him to back down, because he doesn't want to lose that. He wants to qualify to be part of the resurrection of the righteous. Now, qualifying, I mean, Paul's the one who talks that way. That kind of talk bothers some Christians because, they'll say, well, you're making it sound like you have to earn it. Well, whatever it sounds like, I don't know. But Paul says these words. If what Paul says sounds like something different than what your doctrines say, well, then maybe he's not saying what he sounds like, or else maybe whatever your doctrines are may need to be adjusted to what Paul's were, because Paul's were correct, of course. But in any case, the Bible does indicate that we have to persevere and we have to remain and abide in him. That's what Jesus said. And doing so will guarantee us a part of the resurrection of the righteous. But Paul doesn't assume that just because he's a Christian now, or even just because he has preached to others in the past, that necessarily means he's going to qualify. He has to continue, as all Christians do. He has to abide in Christ and make sure that he doesn't fall away and fail Christ in any way. All right, let's talk to Dylan in Beaverton, Oregon. Dylan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Oops, I hit the button, but he disappeared. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there. Dylan, if that was my mistake, then call back. If you just got cold feet, then that's another story. Jeffrey from San Francisco, been hearing from him every day this week. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yes, Steve, it's Easter week, so if you don't mind me calling in every day.
Well, it seems like you got cut off yesterday accidentally. You had two questions. We got one of them out,
right.
And before we got the second one, somehow we got messed up.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I hear an echo, though.
I'm not hearing the echo, so go ahead. I don't know if the listeners are hearing it.
Okay. Well, it's not the question I was going to ask yesterday. I'll ask you this. Steve, was going to ask. Oh, yeah. Remember Woodstock?
Sure.
Did you or your wife have a chance to attend the festival?
No, I was not a hippie. I was a Jesus freak, and I was also pretty young. And traveling to New York would not have been an easy thing for me. Nor was I motivated to. I never really attended a lot of concerts. I liked rock music, but I didn't attend a lot of concerts. I was pretty poor.
I want to ask you. So, do you understand what the Woodstock was all about?
No. Not really. I mean, I just figure it was about drugs and sex and rock and roll.
Uh-huh. Oh no, it was more than that.
Okay. Is this a Bible related question or a Christian related question?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay, go ahead.
So I was going to say, we're being influenced. You would agree that we're being influenced by sources we can't see with our eyes and stuff. And,
sure.
And what was going on? I would say that. During the counterculture movement, that the hippies, they were trying to usher in the age of Aquarius.
Yeah, well, I remember hearing
so
a lot about
they
that.
Believe, yeah, the age of Aquarius is depicted by peace, love, understanding, brotherhood of man, one with the world and one with God.
Okay.
And so that's what was going on, I would say, biblically speaking. But they couldn't do it because only Christ can do that. You know, Christ has the power to do that. Mm-hmm. And so that was a message they were trying to spread to the world. I mean, do you see any biblical parallels with that?
Well, it's more like biblical contradictions to that. Now I'm hearing the echo. I'm not sure why you were hearing one at one point. I'm going to put it on hold. Maybe that'll help. I would say that it would be more like a counterfeit. The kingdom of God, Paul said, is righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. In other words, it's not a perfect world, but it's individuals who have Christ, the sum total of individuals who have Christ, experience the phenomena of spiritual righteousness and spiritual peace and spiritual joy. Now, I believe there's going to be something more than that when Jesus comes back, more than just the spiritual joy. I believe that when Jesus comes back, he'll set up an actual kingdom. His kingdom already exists, but I think that his kingdom will be universally acknowledged, and he'll be present here, and the world will be perhaps what the hippies were dreaming of, but it won't be like that, because their dream included, you know, a lot of drugs and sex and things that won't be part of that. But I think that people have always looked for a utopian age. Certainly the hippies weren't the first to come up with that. But they were like many others in that they would love to have seen an age of peace and righteousness and, well, their ideas of justice or whatever. That's just the world's counterfeit of what God has to offer. And the world has always come up with its counterfeits of what God has to offer. Lots of people want the benefits that Jesus really offers, but they don't want the responsibility that comes with having a king or a lord or somebody that they have to obey, somebody they have to please other than themselves. And I think that's where the hippie movement fell short. And they did fall short because they, in 1969, the same year that Woodstock occurred, the hippies carried a coffin full of flowers through Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, declaring that the hippie movement was dead. And that it was just about that time that the Jesus movement kind of took off. And that's because a lot of the hippies really were looking for what God has to offer, but they didn't know until perhaps around 69 or 70, or even later for some of them, that these things were part of what it means to belong to Christ. But of course, following Christ and obeying him is also a significant part of that. All right. I appreciate your call. God bless you. Let's talk to Travis from San Diego. Travis, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
You heard about the cathedral fire in Paris?
Sure.
Yeah, they said they found the crown upon of Jesus. You think that's true?
I don't believe the crown of thorns that was that in the Notre Dame Cathedral. I don't believe the crown of thorns is likely to be the real crown of thorns that Jesus wore. It could be because I don't know of another place where that crown can be found, but I have my doubts that anyone has it anywhere today.
Yeah, that's 2,000 years ago. How would he save it?
Well, I mean, it's possible that crown would still exist somewhere if somebody did save it. But somebody asked me the same question, I think it was yesterday, and I just said I don't know of anyone who would have had an interest in saving it while it was still around to be located. I suppose when they took it off Jesus' head would be probably when they took him off the cross. And I would assume that anyone who is loyal to Jesus would be following his body to the grave rather than looking for that crown and saying, hey, I want to keep that thing. You know, because after all, they didn't know he's going to rise from the dead. That crown of thorns was just put upon him as a mockery of him. And I don't think his disciples would have thought of, you know, something that was a mockery of him to be a relic that they would have held on to. And anytime after the first day or two, that is after he rose from the dead, I don't know that anyone could locate that crown. It probably was, you know, thrown away somewhere. So I really have doubts that anyone has it. That's my position.
Yeah, me too.
All right.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Travis, thanks for your call. All right, Benjamin from Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Hello, first caller. First time caller. Never called you.
Thanks for calling. Good to have you.
Thanks a lot. You're a very wise man, Steve. I listen to you a lot. Anyways, hey, Steve, the reason I'm calling because I think about a week ago, there was a man that he was talking about that he was struggling with adultery. I need you to try to talk him through it and stuff. Remember? I think it was last Tuesday or something.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. You know, to tell you the truth, I have so many calls, I forget when any of them were. But go ahead.
Yeah, it's a blur. I get it. But have you ever heard the teaching about communion? Basically like the Passover.
I'm not sure which teaching you're talking about. Yeah, the communion that Jesus had with his disciples was Passover. Yeah.
Actually taking the communion itself to basically to fulfill Romans 6, you know, like dying to yourself, killing the flesh.
Well, I mean, we can do that with or without taking communion. I mean, dying to yourself isn't a matter. It's a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of what you put through your mouth or into your stomach.
No, but I'm saying that it's a great help because, for example, in Luke, Jesus specifically said, Luke 22, he says, this is my body, which is given for you, and do this in remembrance of me. Basically, you know, he died for us, you know, and that fulfills the Passover.
Yeah,
like
it does.
Communion.
Yeah, it does.
This is where I learned it from. You know Perry Stone, right?
Yeah, I've heard of Perry Stone. I've never listened to him. Go ahead.
But his teaching, I found that works. It was called The Meal That Heals. Basically, to get to the point, you know how people, like, take prescription or, you know, they basically people take things in order to feel better. But wasn't Jesus spiritual food?
Well, that's making certain assumptions about the communion that I'm not necessarily making. See, I don't believe that taking communion is literally taking the body of Jesus or the blood of Jesus. I personally think that his statement, this is my body and this is my blood, because it, in fact, was a Passover meal. He was going through the ritual of the Passover in which they normally would say, this bread is the bread of affliction of our fathers in Egypt. That is to say, they'd be remembering their ancestors who had suffered in Egypt, and the bread represented the affliction of their fathers in Egypt. Now, Jesus simply changed it and said, he didn't say this bread is the bread of affliction of our fathers in Egypt. He said, this bread is my body. And my affliction, you know, for you, my body's broken for you. So he's saying from now on, whenever you eat this, instead of remembering what happened in Egypt, you remember me and what happened when I, you know, died on the cross for you is what he's basically saying. So he's saying that just as, the communion meal or the Passover meal that they were taking and had always taken all their lives, and the Jews had taken it for hundreds of years every year, it was a memorial of salvation. God had saved them from Egypt, you know, 1,400 years earlier, and they remembered it with this meal. And the things they ate in the meal were represented symbolically, things that reminded them of that original Passover. Now, Jesus is basically, you're right, fulfilling the Passover and saying, from now on, when you eat it, you remember me. Do it in remembrance of me. And when he said, this bread is my body, he's not making a statement that the bread was turning into his body any more than in the regular ritual when they said, this bread is the bread of affliction of our fathers. They weren't saying that something was magically happening to the bread and it's turning into something else. Instead of being a current loaf of bread, now it's a loaf of bread that belongs to a period 1,400 years ago. It's just the language of symbolism. And so I don't think there's any suggestion that it was, you know, his actual body that they're eating. And by the way, the disciples didn't think so either. I mean, they would have understood this, as I'm saying, because they were familiar with the Passover ritual, and they knew that the language was used that way. And if Peter, for example, probably if any of the disciples had really believed Jesus was saying, now when you eat this bread, you're really eating my flesh and you're drinking my blood, they would have been repulsed. First of all, Jews don't eat human flesh. They're not cannibals, and they don't drink blood. And therefore, if they thought that he was saying, this cup really is my blood, drink it, this bread really is my body, eat it, they would have revolted against it. And we know this because we know how Peter was when later on in Acts chapter 10, when Jesus actually told Peter to eat unclean animals. He said, not so, Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean. I'm not going to do that. So, I mean, it'd be much more offensive to Peter to eat human flesh and drink human blood. That, I mean, he would have said something if he thought Jesus meant something like that. Of course, he knew that Jesus didn't. There's nothing in the Bible that would suggest at all that the elements turn into the body and blood of Jesus. And by the way, there's no teaching in the scripture that says that if you take communion, it will heal you either physically or spiritually. There's actually nothing in the Bible that teaches that communion has any impact on your spiritual life other than to remind you of Jesus' death and resurrection. Which, by the way, other things can remind you of that too. You can remember his death and resurrection just as you're sitting here listening to the radio. You don't need to take communion in order to remember it. But Jesus said, when you do eat this meal, make sure you're now remembering me instead of course, what you used to remember when you took this meal, which was the Exodus from Egypt. So I'm seeing the whole picture somewhat differently than you are. But I appreciate your sharing, and I'm glad I got a chance to address it. Now, we have people waiting, and we have another half hour ahead, but we do have a break coming up here in just a few seconds. So instead of taking a caller and then having to interrupt with the break in a few seconds, I'll just wait and take a caller after the break. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're on for an hour every weekday, and we're at the half hour point now. We're going to have another half hour if you just stay tuned. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We're on quite a lot of radio stations, and they all charge a lot of money. Well, some of them are giving us a pretty good break, but actually we're paying a lot of money to radio stations. And we don't sell anything, don't have commercials, don't have sponsors. So we stay on the air just as people who listen and would like to keep listening someday in the future. Maybe they want to support it. If you'd like to, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Now, you can also donate from the website, but if you haven't found the website, realize that you don't have to donate there. Everything there is free, and there's hundreds of resources at our website, all of them free. You should check that out if you have not. That's thenarrowpath.com. Stay tuned for 30 seconds, and we'll be right back for another half hour.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com. where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour before we end this program today. We are taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, feel free to call this number, 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. And I want to announce something that's coming up here in just a little over a week, and that is I'm going to be teaching in Hawaii for a couple of weeks, the last, the week that begins at the end of this month and then the first weeks of May. I'm going to be teaching in Honolulu 1 week, and I'm going to be teaching in Kona the next week. And I say that because although my mornings are full because I'm teaching every day for Youth with a Mission, my evenings are pretty flexible. And so if people who are listening in Hawaii want to set up any kind of a gathering, it can be in a home. It can be larger than a home. But if you want me to speak someplace, feel free to give me a call. We'll put it on the calendar while the dates are free. So if you're interested in doing something like that, just write to me, steve@thenarrowpath.com, and let me know, and we'll try to set something up in either Honolulu or Kona at the end of this month. All right, let's talk to Dylan from Beaverton. Hey, Dylan, did we get cut off or something? I think something happened.
Yeah, I did earlier, yeah.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. So I had a question about 1 Timothy 2:15, where it says women shall be saved through childbearing if they remain something. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, if
right
they
now.
Continue in faith and some other things that Paul lists, yeah.
Right. Could you just explain what he means by that?
Okay. Paul says, nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. It's interesting how he changes it from she to they, and I'm not sure if that's just Paul, not being consistent with his grammar, which is sometimes the case, or if there's a significance there. Paul has just said in the earlier verses that he does not place women in the role of eldership in the church. And he says that's partly due to the fact that God created man first and made the woman second to be the assistant to man, but also because the woman took the lead in sinning, first of all, that she ate the forbidden fruit before man did. And so her created the creation order, and also her role in the fall, Paul says, are influencing him not to place women in the highest roles, the eldership roles in the church. Those are not the highest roles. In fact, if anything, they're the lowest roles. Jesus said, whoever would be chief has to be the slave of all. But he says, nevertheless, she, presumably he means a generic woman, women in general, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and self-control. What does it mean she'll be saved in childbearing? There are some who believe that what Paul is saying is that even though woman took the lead, as it were, in sinning, which Paul has just mentioned, women will also take the lead in bringing salvation from sin, in the sense that it would be a woman, Mary, who would bring the Savior into the world. And interestingly enough, the curse that came upon the woman when she sinned was that she'd have pain and sorrow in childbearing increased. Well, it'll be childbearing. That activity is what will bring salvation and to herself and to others. She who has, initiated the problem of sin will also be the one that God uses to initiate the salvation from sin by her childbearing. Now, I have to say that's an explanation that I haven't really been persuaded of, though quite a few commentators have taken something like that. And since many do, there may be more virtue in that particular explanation than I have given it credit for. I tend to see it this way. When Paul says that women will be saved in childbearing, what does saved mean? It doesn't mean they're going to go to heaven because they have children. Certainly, the Apostle Paul knew very well there are women who give up marriage and child raising for the sake of the gospel, and he actually says that's a good thing. And of course, if that was going to forfeit their salvation by not having children, then that he wouldn't say that was a good thing. He's not teaching that, you know, that salvation in the sense that we sometimes think of it, that is, you know, going to heaven when you die, is connected at all with a woman bearing children. But in the Bible, salvation is a much broader term than we often think of it. We often think of salvation merely as getting my ticket to heaven so I don't go to hell. But in fact, in the Bible, salvation is a total holistic restoration to a relationship with God as it should be and to our state as we should be, like Christ. Salvation isn't just our redemption from crimes we've committed, but actually salvation from our own sinfulness so that we can live a holy life. And holy living is every bit as much a part of biblical salvation, which has many aspects to it, as is the part that we call justification. Holy living, we call it sanctification. That's part of salvation too. And I think what Paul may be saying is that although women will not be, serving in the ministry of being elders, they will serve in another kind of ministry. And in that role, God will, you know, sanctify them. They will experience the sanctifying effects that come from motherhood. Now, let me just say that in the next chapter, or two chapters over, chapter 4, Paul said to Timothy himself, verse 16, he said, take heed to yourself and to the doctrine, continue in them, for in doing so, you will save both yourself and those who hear you. He's saying that if Timothy continues to teach good doctrine and continues in the ministry that God's given him of doing this, he will, in a sense, save himself and those who hear him. Now, it sounds to me like he's talking about Timothy working out his own salvation through fulfilling the calling that God has given him. And I think that may be what Paul means two chapters earlier when he says that women will be saved in the role of motherhood, because that's the role that most women have. Not all women do, and he's not saying that every woman has to. In fact, he says what they have to do is to continue in faith, love, holiness, and self-control. That's what really he's referring to as the condition for their salvation. But the saved in the process of childbearing and child-rearing, I think, is implied by that, because when you have children, you have to raise them. So I think he's saying motherhood. I think he's saying that most women, their calling in God is with reference to motherhood, to bearing and rearing children. And this is something that, as they continue in it, along with their faith and love and holiness and self-control, that they will experience the sanctifying that is involved in salvation. Now, some women have told me this very thing about themselves. I don't know this from my own experience. Obviously, I've never had children. That is, I've never been a mother. I've had children. I'm the father of five children, but I never gave birth to children. But many women have told me that before they actually had children, they were very self-centered people, and that they cared about little else but themselves, which is, of course, what sin is and what we need to be delivered from. But they have told me that in having children, it's the first time they actually cared about something more than themselves, and in laying down their lives sacrificially for, you know, a child that they'd born, they learned how to be sacrificially loving, which is exactly what sanctification desires of us and does for us. It makes us more like Christ, more sacrificial, more loving, and less selfish. Well, many women, not all certainly, but many women have found that as they continued in faith and love and holiness and self-control and in the role of motherhood, that it's that very role of motherhood that was the mechanism that God used to teach them to be unselfish and to be, you know, to be more like Christ. And so maybe that's the right answer. I don't know. I mean, Paul's statement is somewhat ambiguous, and there are different answers given by different commentators. But I've had a number of women tell me that's how they understood it, and I think that that could be right.
Yeah, that sounds, actually, now that you say it, it makes perfect sense. So thank you.
All right, Dylan, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling. God bless you. All right. Next caller is Daniel from Tacoma, Washington. Daniel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yesterday... Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, yesterday you said that... double feed of some sort. Luke,
I'm sorry.
23,
are you getting an echo?
You said that the comma is in the right place, and Jesus did say that today you will be with me in paradise.
Yeah.
Yet 3 days later, in John 20:17, he tells Mary, "Do not touch me. I did not ascend to my Father yet." So, which one is right?
Well, they're both right. Jesus and the thief were in paradise that day, I believe. And yet when he rose from the dead, he had yet to ascend to the Father, as we know, because it was 40 days later, we read he actually ascended physically to his Father. To say that he was in paradise the day he died is not telling us where his physical presence was, obviously. I mean, I believe the Bible teaches that when we die, our physical bodies are in the grave on earth, but our spirits have another place that we go. And I think that that's what he's referring to when he talks to this thief. You'll be with me in paradise. Doesn't mean that you and I will physically ascend up into heaven. But when he told Mary, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended my Father." Actually, he says, "I have yet to ascend to my Father." It means he's going to still go away again. She thinks he's back for good. She finds him after he's risen from the dead. She's all excited. She's hanging on to him. He says, "Don't cling to me." I know some translations say, "Don't touch me." The word in the Greek is, I believe, hapto, which means to touch or to cling to. And most modern translations would agree. He's saying, "Don't cling to me because I'm still going away again. I have yet to ascend to my Father." And in that statement, he's referring to physically ascending like he did in Acts chapter 1.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Okay. Let's talk to Dale from Sacramento. Dale, good to hear from you. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello there again.
Yeah.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
The question I have was, you were talking earlier about the Jesus movement, and so that reminded me of Larry Norman, who had a famous song called
I Wish We'd All Been Ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I always assumed that the ones that were left behind were the ones that were not ready. So, but I heard a preacher yesterday on KFIA say that Larry Norman actually was in wrong interpretation, and that the people that were left behind were the people
the
that were taken up were the unbelievers. The people that were left behind were the believers.
Well, I don't know who the preacher was, but let me just clarify. I believe Larry Norman was mistaken, as were many of us back then. I knew Larry. In fact, he and I, over dinner shortly before he died, we were talking about that song. And he was saying, you know, a lot of people say I was teaching a pre-trib rapture, but he says, I wasn't really making it clear. I think he was trying to distance himself from it. He certainly was in the song. He did present a pre-trib rapture view. And, you know, back when he wrote the song, I was teaching a pre-trib rapture view, and so were all the teachers I knew. So I can't fault him for having held that view. I even wrote a song when I was in my band that was a pre-trib rapture song, too. It was kind of commonplace in the 70s, and Larry wrote that probably in 69. But it was very commonplace in the early 70s for Christian music to refer to the rapture coming up real soon and the pre-trib, because that's the teaching we were all under. The Calvary Chapel movement was really strong on the pre-trib rapture. Hal Lindsey and his books and other writers were strong in it. So Larry and many others did believe in a pre-trib rapture. I'm not clear when I talked to him again over dinner that time whether he had, what his view had become, but he was saying that he was kind of denying that his song was really advocating that view. In any case, I would agree with those who say that Larry is mistaken. And in saying so, I would say I was mistaken, too, because I thought the same thing he did. But now I think otherwise. Now, to say that those who are taken up are the lost is not really true. The Bible doesn't talk about anyone being taken up. In the passage that's relevant to it, it's in Matthew 24 and also in the parallel in Luke 17. What Jesus said is, but as it was in the days of Noah, this is verse 37, Matthew 24, 37. As it was in the days of Noah, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in one in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you don't know when your what hour your Lord will come. So Jesus said, when he comes, it'll be like the days of Noah. What happened then? Noah and his family entered into the safety of the ark, and the flood came and took the rest of them away. So those who were taken in the story of Noah, according to Jesus, are the wicked. Now, they weren't taken up. They weren't taken into the sky or anything like that. There's no reference to anyone being taken into the sky in the passage, just being taken. And that's an idiom that means killed. They were taken in death. They were in judgment. And so also he says that's how it'll be when the Son of Man comes. One will be taken and the other left. Now, this sounds to me like what it says in Psalm 91. I think it's verse 11 and 12, but I'm not sure. I may have the verses wrong, but no, it's earlier in the chapter. It says, you know, 1,000 will fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you behold the reward of the wicked. Now, there it talks about people who are in near proximity, and the wicked are taken. You know, they're killed. They fall. They don't go up in the sky. They fall. They're taken out of the world in death, and the righteous remain. So this is, I think, what Jesus is teaching also. And if you look at the parallel over in Luke 17, by the way, that's Psalm 91, verse 7. But in the same teaching in Luke 17, it goes like this. Jesus said in verse 34, I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding together. One will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. And they answered and said to him, where, Lord? Now, the disciples actually asked Jesus, where are these people being taken? And he said to them, wherever the bodies or the corpses are, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now, he's talking about corpses here. You want to know where they are. It's never hard to find corpses. There's always vultures or birds, you know, eagles around to eat them, you know. So they're saying, where are they taken to? And his answer is cryptic. He's basically saying, well, look for the vultures, you know, if you don't know where they are. Wherever the corpse is, the eagles will be gathered there. So I believe he's saying they're killed. And also just a few verses earlier, when in Luke 17, he tells that story of Noah again. And it says, as the days of Noah, so shall be the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It says in Luke 17:27, the flood came and destroyed them. The parallel in Matthew 24 is the flood came and took them. So being taken is being destroyed. It's not a reference to the rapture.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, Dale. God bless you. I appreciate your call today. Let's see how much time we got. We can take some more calls here. Deborah from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much, Steve. Uh-huh. Yeah, so my question is, in your opinion, what's the difference between if I don't believe the Calvinistic doctrine, but I believe in Arminianism,
uh-huh.
What's the difference? Like, if I go, I've been going to this church in Seattle, and I found out, you know, that predominantly they're Calvinistic, but I talked to them, and they said, well, it's fine with us, you know, I mean, you can be part of our church. They
sure.
just don't want me to be divisive, you know, which is fine with me. But I like the church. I like the people. I like their activities. So my question is, does it make any difference in my Christian day-to-day living whether I'm attending a Calvinist church, in your opinion? And if there is a big difference, then I was wondering if there's some way, maybe through email, that people, there's a, might be some people in Seattle that know of a good Bible-believing church that they could suggest. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with going to a Calvinistic church, though I also am not a Calvinist. I'm an Arminian. But, if they're not making an issue of it, sounds like that church is not making an issue of it. They say, well, it doesn't bother us as long as you're not divisive. I think that's the right attitude. I mean, every church is either going to lean toward Calvinism or Arminianism, and whatever one they lean toward, if their attitude is, well, you can disagree with us as long as you're not divisive. And that's assuming that they're not planning to be divisive either, of course. I mean, if you go to a church and every time they give a sermon, they're pushing for Calvinist ideas, specifically Calvinist ideas, then you probably will find yourself a bit frustrated because you're not going to agree with them. And you might want to find a church that you agree somewhat more with on those things, though there's nothing wrong with continuing to be there. As long as they're not threatened by you, you don't have to feel threatened by them. And as far as how your Christian life will go, your Christian life will hardly ever be determined by where you're going to church on Sunday. It's amazing how many people define their Christianity as their church affiliation. But really, going to church on Sunday doesn't affect anything in a person's life who isn't living for Jesus throughout the whole week. And, for example, if somebody isn't living for Jesus through the whole week, going to church on Sunday isn't going to make a Christian out of them unless they repent and start living for Jesus as a result of that. But going to church doesn't give you any brownie points with God, and it doesn't necessarily dictate what kind of life you're going to live. However, if you go to a church that teaches well and you get good biblical instruction, that will help inform your Christian life during the week, and that's a good thing. But if your church doesn't do that, your own studies can inform your Christian life, and you can live for Jesus very nicely. The main thing I look for in a church is not whether they agree with any of my doctrines on those kinds of things, but would be whether they are people who exhibit the fruit of the Spirit. Are they loving? If they're showing love, that's what Jesus said is the mark of a disciple. If they're not showing love, then there's no reason to believe they are disciples. That's what Jesus said. By this, all men will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. So in a church where they're not exhibiting very much love, I would say they're not giving really any evidence that they're Christians. They have maybe preach Christian doctrine, but that doesn't mean they're Christians. Lots of people who believe Christian doctrines have never been converted. So I don't think there's anything dangerous about going to a church like that. It sounds like, from what they told you, sounds like they have a good attitude. I hope they do. All right, let's talk to Luis in Massachusetts. Hello, Luis.
Hello.
Hey, you need to turn your radio off or something, because we're getting some feedback from that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be quick.
Go ahead.
My first one is, how can you explain me this passage where Saul consulted a witch woman, a medium, and then to call spirit of Samuel after Samuel dead, and then we know Samuel was a Christian. How could that be? We know that woman was a Christian,
yes.
And then she was able to call the spirit of Samuel and talk to him.
Yeah, well,
my
how
second
could,
question.
Let's work on the first one first, in case we don't have time for the second. Then we can go to a second. The woman that you're talking about is the witch in Endor whom Saul approached and wanted her to call up in a seance the spirit of Samuel. And she apparently was able to do so. Now, you're wondering, how that could happen. I don't think that normally does happen, but I think it did on that occasion. I believe that normally if you go to a seance, which is, by the way, forbidden in the Bible, and Saul was not right to go and ask for this. In fact, the Bible says he died the next day because of this, because he went to a witch on this occasion and asked for this. So he was in violation of God's commands by simply trying to contact the spirit of Samuel. And I think that if you do that, if you go to a seance, you will not probably contact genuinely the person you think you're contacting. It's probably a demonic counterfeit. In this case, however, God was doing something special. God was going to judge Saul the next day, and he allowed Samuel to come up and rebuke Saul and to tell him that. That doesn't mean that God approved of the witch, what she was doing or what Saul was doing. But since they were doing it anyway, God just stepped into the situation and sent Samuel up to give him this message. I've heard of other people, too, who were doing some things they shouldn't do, you know, doing the Ouija board or doing the I Ching or other things like that, different forms of divination. And God got through to them with a message rebuking them for it. So I think that God can do that. He can do whatever he wants to do. And in this case, although it's wrong and forbidden to conduct seances, the Bible indicates that God allowed Samuel to come up this time because of God's desire, frankly, to rebuke Saul. And so he used Samuel to do it. Okay? You got another question? You need to turn your radio off. Please turn your radio off.
My second question is, can you explain me what that means when Jesus went to preach unto the dead?
Okay. That Jesus went and preached to the dead, or the spirits that are in prison, is really what that says. It's in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 20. 1 Peter 3:20, here we go. It says, well, in verse 19, by whom, that is by the Spirit, who is mentioned in the previous verse, by whom he also went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared. Now it says that Jesus, through his Spirit, preached to the spirits who are in prison in the days of Noah. I believe the spirits in prison in this case are those who were, at the time of Peter, they were in prison. They were in Hades, but they were not there when they were preached to. These are people who were preached to in their lifetime, but who are now in prison. And they were preached to by the Spirit of Christ, I believe, through Noah. I believe that what Peter is saying is that Noah was operating through the Spirit of Christ, and that therefore Jesus was preaching through his Spirit to those people who were rebellious in the days of Noah, who have now since died and their spirits are now in prison, but they weren't dead at the time. I'm sorry we're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.